Welcome to SLA, where you can learn to avoid gaslighting yourself and your language teaching practices,
break down academic gatekeeping on second language acquisition,
and girl boss your way through dynamic, engaging, and research-based language teaching.
I'm Ben Fisher Rodriguez, and my pronouns are he, him.
I'm Bill Langley, and my pronouns are he, him.
I'm Brian Smith, and my pronouns are he, they.
Let's slay.
Welcome back to another episode of SLA, Second Language for Everyone. I'm Bill Langley, and on this episode, we're going to talk about some questioning strategies. And we've got a great article from Dr. Karen Lichtman and Angela Gardner about using either-or questioning in class. But to start off, for gaslight, we wanted to talk about some things that can potentially go wrong with some questioning that we do every single day in our classrooms. You may have heard of the term circling, and circling was a technique that helps teachers ask a lot of questions about very limited vocabulary. So you might say, there is a dog. Students, is there a dog? Students, is there a dog or is there a cat? Students, what is there? So that's a kind of a quick example of circling. And I think a lot of times when we are being trained, if you've ever been to one of those national teaching with comprehensible input conferences, you may have learned circling, and it kind of goes like you got either or questions, yes or no questions, and W questions. So who, what, when, where, why, and how. But one of the problems that we tend to fall into, especially as like beginning the journey of moving towards proficiency driven instruction or acquisition driven instruction, proficiency based
acquisition proficiency based instruction comprehensible
communicative language teaching, yeah,
technical, yes, all the, yeah, yep, all the things,
whatever alphabet soup of acronyms you like to use with this language teaching stuff. We are often taught that like, you do this question, then you do this question, then you do this question, then you do this question, and that gets really, really repetitive and really, really boring for students. I think in like a simple sentence, there's something like 16 different questions that you can ask just with those four types of questions, either or, yes, no, W questions, or what did I say the other one?
I think yes and no.
Yes, no.
Yeah,
yeah, yes, yeah. And no. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So if you're starting out and you really want to get better at question asking, and I think it's perfectly normal, if not advised, the first couple times that you're trying to do these questioning strategies, that you even script out the questions that you think you want to ask. So if you're reading something with your class and you've got a projected story on the board, maybe you're writing down a couple questions that you really want to make sure that you ask because you want to get a lot of repetitions on a specific word.
And that's the crux of circling, right? Yeah. It's like getting, if there's new core vocabulary that we want to introduce to students, verbs or, structures that include verbs and nouns and adjectives and everything. It's just trying to get a lot of repetition. So you're trying to repeat those things as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And because you've established the meaning of those phrases to your students, they get that, they receive that repetition as comprehensible input, which means that they're going to hopefully acquire kind of the underlying structure, if not at least the vocabulary words that you're working with.
Right. And on that, like, another pitfall that I think we sometimes fall into is you do not have to circle everything. That is going to get really, really, really bad repetitive to your students. And so the goal is to end up getting to a point where we can ask these questions spontaneously in a variety of orders, but something instead of asking questions about every single sentence, every single time that there's a new sentence, something to maybe focus on is every time that there is a new word or a new phrase or new information. So that way you're not asking, if we already know that there's a dog, we don't need to go back. When we say the dog runs to the park, was it, does the dog run to the park? No, but you could say, does the dog run to the park or does the dog run to the circus? If park is the new word, right? So you don't need to focus on dog, because we've already established what that is. And one really, really great tip that I learned about from about circling and practicing circling came from Michelle Kint, who this past year was the, well, in the past couple of years, I think, was the director of the Fluency Magic Conference. This past year, it was in Denver. It was a lot of fun. And one of the strategies that I learned from her is to take a little note card and write out a sentence, and then you can separate maybe like the verb, the noun, an adjective, and then go ahead and write in a couple different options for each thing. So then when you're asking questions about it, you've got different variables that you can add in. So instead of having to think on your th feet, is there a dog or is there a cat? Because you couldn't think of anything else, you've already got some ideas written down. And ideally, those other options would also be things that your students already know, so that you're not having to introduce a bunch of new words just so that you can circle one other word.
You can
So
also, can
that
you,
is
do,
something
do you
that
also use
was
just
really,
like,
really great. Another thing, if you're in a department,
I was just gonna ask you, do you also just use cognates that are so like glaringly cognate-y, you
oh
know?
yeah, for sure.
You can use
For
that if you're
sure.
not sure, if you
Uh,
can't come up
or
with like an acquired word
or
on the fly, just super cognate.
yep, or proper nouns. That's another great way to make sure that your circling is comprehensible. And if you're in a department, or even if you just want to practice circling on your own, another technique that I learned this past year at Fluency Matters, which I think came from the coaching group, which is also run by Michelle Kent and Terry Wiechert, was we started the practice with being in a circle, introducing ourselves, and asking a question about our introduction to the person. So I would say, "My name's Bill," and then the next question, then I would ask a question to the next person: "Is my name Bill, or is my name Ben Bryan?" And then the person would answer, "Bill," and I would be able to give a response then. "Yeah, my name's Bill. My name's not Brian. My name's not Ben. My name's Bill." Which brings me to my next point. You can do a threefer. Have we heard the term threefer? Ben, have you heard the term
I have
threefer?
heard three for Brian. Is that in your
Brian,
vocabulary?
do you know that?
I mean, yeah, it makes sense. Two for three for, why not?
Yeah. So with like a negative question, you can get three repetitions of a word by asking a negative question. So, is my name Ben? No, my name isn't Ben. My name is Bill. So right away, I get like three repetitions of that phrase, "My name is," and in kind of different contexts as a question, which looks different in Spanish than it does in English, or French instead of English. So those are some just like quick tips, and hopefully you can practice some questioning strategies. And I think we're even kind of moving away from calling it circling because we don't want to reinforce that you have to ask all of these questions in the circle, just the ones that will help you clarify meaning to your students.
Yeah, I will say I'm totally with you, Bill, in that like sometimes the way that it's introduced, even I've seen it in publications, makes it also seem like it's an activity that you do separately. like, all right, everyone, it's circling time. And then everyone, gears up for circling time. But it really is in the flow of any conversation, any learning that your class is doing all together. You can take any of those statements and circle any part of them. And for us as, advanced or higher speakers of our languages, it feels goofy and silly. We have to remember that when our students are starting where they are, if they're novices especially, the circling questions feel like a breath of fresh air because they get to pause on those structures, on the new sounds, on the new structures, on the new words, and really take them in and soak them in. And it's also a nice confirmation for them when they answer a choral question, for instance, they all answer together a circling question, and you immediately affirm, yeah, totally. That's a form of formative assessment for you, but also for them that kind of empowers them to be like, I'm on the right course. I'm doing the thing.
I remember when I first started circling, my students made fun of me because they could predict what my next question was. And I forget even what it was, but like they just caught on to it really, really quickly on circling. And I mean that was 10, 11 years ago now, and I still remember it.
And I think too that you said you shouldn't circle everything, but one of my learnings, I think I shied away from it at first because it can feel very mechanical and silly and stuff. But if you are doing it in just like a do a formulaic way over and over again, but I think I have used it more and more, especially with my novices, just to get that sense of confidence. It is almost a good way to snap back to focus, and it just gets more language into the classroom.
And it's not just for novices by any means. So, your more advanced students and your upper levels also need that the same repetition. If it's a new word or a new structure, they still need that same repetition. Just because they might be processing it a little bit quicker doesn't mean that you can't pause and ask a question.
I think, well, I think we're going to get into this a little bit more later, but I like the idea of, I mean, like we want to use circling to get the repetitions in, but I think it's also okay to actually use it to find out information that you want to know. Like, do you have dogs or cats? Do you go to the park with your dog? Like, you can still repeat the same word that you want them to get repetitions on, but actually use it for a communicative purpose, and to find out more about your students.
I love that. Yeah. Sometimes you end up finding, I end up being like, do you have a dog or a cat? And the kid is like, how do you say both? And then I'm like, haha, and then you get those words again, again, and again. That's wonderful.
Yeah, great point.
Sweet. Let's ungatekeep, or let's gatekeep. I don't know. Let's, I don't know. I never want to like say these things. I was like, let's gaslight. But here we are. Let's ungatekeep. We read an article, from the Foreign Language Annals that was titled The Impact of Questioning Strategies on Target Language Production and Learner Confidence. This was by Angela Gardner and Karen Lichtman. Bill introduced very succinctly the kind of question ladder that we use when we work with students. We start with yes or no questions because those require the least amount of output. They just yes or no, and that's a simple, simple response. And then there's either or questions, and then there's W questions. And we think of either or questions and as yes or no questions as easier because the answer is contained within the question. And then open-ended questions like W questions, kind of bespeak the higher order thinking that our schools are looking for, that kind of critical thought, because they have to create and connect and synthesize and all that sort of stuff. So we think when we hear, should I use more yes or no questions? Should I use more either or questions? Or should I use more open-ended questions? That most research points towards us using the more cognitively demanding question, which would be an open-ended question. But the researchers in this study wanted to tackle what works actually best for second language acquisition, because second language acquisition is different than a content area where much of this work was being done, maybe. And also, how can we balance student engagement, with also confidence building? So They kind of added another element into this. It was mostly about the questioning techniques and what effects those had. But they also ask students how confident they would be approaching an output task with or without the use of translators or artificial intelligence. And we know from experience that when students get some sort of task that is too demanding for them, that's beyond their proficiency level, that they don't have the vocabulary for, that they sometimes lean back onto those online translators and AI and stuff. I'm sure you have experienced that in your practice. So, this study question was, do students produce more of a targeted structure more accurately while perceiving less need to rely on online translation tools when you use one kind of questioning over another? And the two kinds of questioning that they used, or the technical names I learned, were contingent questioning, which is an either-or question, or divergent questioning, which is an open-ended question. So they examined this research question. I mean, how many you get a dollar every time I say question. In a high school Spanish one class, they had about 68 students total that they split into two even groups. One got the treatment, one didn't. The pre kind of pre-test that they gave students was just a picture. They drew a pic They had a picture of a park scene and had students write as much in Spanish as they possibly could about it. This is an output task that's based on describing the function there is description of a scene. So that's language use. And then the experimental task itself was students would get pictures and they would get some questions to answer about the picture. We would say the divergent question group would get open-ended questions. So if you see a picture of a girl doing something, it says, what is the girl doing? Where is the girl? Why does the girl feel this way? I don't know if they went that far. But those sorts of questions, open-ended. Whereas the treatment group would get something more like the girl is drinking water or the girl is eating pizza. The girl is at the park or the girl is at the circus. So they would get those sorts of questions where, again, the answer is already contained within the question. And again, we think that, open-ended is going to challenge them more and make them have to pull more out of their brains. It has that desirable difficulty that we hear about in education. So maybe it's going to do more for their acquisition. Then they did a post-test where they essentially had another free write on a picture where they saw a scene and they had to describe it as much as they could in Spanish. And they took a survey that where they rated their temptation to use translations. After that, the researchers rated the samples for how many verbs did they use? How many of those verbs did they conjugate? How many of those verbs did they conjugate correctly? And both group wrote more. They went through a Spanish class period and then they wrote more after Spanish class. That's great. The input worked. Ding, ding, ding. But the experimental group, which is a group that got more either-or questions that had the answer contained within the question, made greater gains in using conjugation at all and greater gains in their accuracy of their conjugation. And they even had a slightly greater variety of verbs in that group. They use more language, kind of a greater variety. Not to mention they were more confident because they were given options. They felt less temptation to use online translation. So, this is a small study. This is one class period. We didn't get long-term effects. But the authors say that basically, when looking at this, there are a lot of benefits, potential benefits, and no real detriments to using more contingent questioning, especially with novices like they studied. This can help build their confidence because the questions themselves are input. It's a modeling as a way of doing focus on form, right? Because the questions that you pose have correct forms in them. And this helps kind of get around the when students are less confident, that reliance on Google Translate, that temptation. So the researchers offered at the end, obviously if you do one sort of question, kind of like Bill was saying, like if you get into a style of doing something, your students are going to pick up on it and get bored. And then just they'll know what comes next, and it just will kind of become a pl like plodding trudge. So maybe you do a cycle of two to three divergent questions, so two to three either-or questions, and then an open-ended question. And that can help build the confidence while also giving more input to help build the learner system and build, their capacity for output in the language. What are some takeaways? What are some thoughts that y'all had as we were reading this article? I really enjoyed this. I thought it was a good push to use more of those either or questions.
Yeah, I thought it was great. I was really I mean, I guess I like had predicted that probably using the contingent questions with beginners would be more effective, but it was really interesting to see like that it was specifically effective in increasing their like accuracy with the verb conjugations, and it makes a lot of sense. You know, they are getting that additional input, and it also makes me think about what we had talked about for a little bit in the previous episode about structured input. Because it's like you are intentionally using these forms because you want the students to be able to then use them in their writing afterwards. This is kind of like a confirmation that that seems to work, especially if you've got a language that has different forms for different, you know, subjects, like you got first person, second person, third person, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, I mean, it seemed like that was kind of showing what I had anticipated and in an interesting way.
Totally. And I think that when Bill was talking about circling, one of the criticisms of storytelling-based methods specifically has been that, you get a lot of third person singular and maybe sometimes third person plural, which are the most common forms in a language, I think, if I remember correctly. But that, that the kids are just constantly producing first person pronoun and then third person verb form. But we can circle ourselves into those questions as well, into those contingent questions. I do this, or so and so does this. It sees me, or it sees this. That sort of thing, and that can help get that focus on form in.
A question that will display a little bit of my area of growth that I need to work on, since you brought it up. What are you doing? So say you ask a question about yourself, and how do you train students to respond to that? Like, do you try to get them to use you? Like, oh, you do it. Or do you try to get them to say I? What do you think about that?
That's tricky because I've had that. I've actually been getting on my students about that, where if I said some sentence in German and I said, I do this, and then I say in English, what did I just say? And they say, you did this, this, and this. And I always try to say now, I try to be like, I, no, please, I understand that you're talking to me about me, but I want you to say, I do this. Because yeah, we want to make sure that all those wires are linked to the right things. So
Yeah,
I think
all
that
the
maybe
connections are
Bill.
being made at the right place.
Yeah, and the correct form meaning connection. So I think, Bill, you accidentally revealed one of my weaknesses as well, and so I think I'm gonna try to be a little bit better. Where if I do ask a circle question that wouldn't elicit a response that's about me, Herr Fischer Rodriguez, that maybe I throw them a bone and write on the board like, ah, you and stuff like that. I just don't input the formal you as strictly with my students in German as maybe I could, just to show them that, this is what polite German sounds like, and this is how you would address somebody who's in, who is a teacher who's you don't know or something like that. So I think you actually give me some good to think about, is that I should probably offer those options and maybe even loudly just mouth it to them as like a way of being like Sie gehen zum Football Spiel, like that sort of thing. And then they're like, ah, yes, that is the answer. Because yeah, there are so many forms that you could model with that, asking questions about yourself. Yeah, you could also miss it, and you could also have them, think that it doesn't really matter. Just kind of say things while looking at you and it'll be fine. But we want them to be able to use that accurately in talking about different subjects. Brian, what are your thoughts on that?
So I was actually listening to another podcast earlier today where they were talking about the concept of the super seven verbs. Like, the seven verbs are the most commonly used in a specific language that have to do with like being or existing, doing, you know, those kinds of things. And I was kind of thinking about it because, like, well, I guess the target language of the podcasters, was Mandarin Chinese. I think you know which podcast I'm talking about. But I've actually been in like a demo class for Mandarin Chinese where that like this kind of circling was used for specifically supersubordinate verbs. And I was thinking about how like it's really effective because the verbs don't inflect. Like it's just one word for eats. Like there's no I eat versus she eats, right? So I was thinking about like doing the same thing for French, which does inflect. And there are like, saying like you formal do this versus I do this. It sounds completely different for a lot of verbs. So I was thinking about like if I were to do that, I would have to really kind of chunk it and like start out with only doing third person and then like slowly work in the first person and the second person formal. Because I couldn't just like use the same verb but use different persons because it might really get confusing to those novice students. So.
A couple shout outs based on what you just said. If everyone is following along with the podcast website, not just through your podcast provider, we do have a spot where our pod roll, is that the name
Yeah,
of it?
our
The
pod
pod roll?
roll.
Yeah, our pod roll. We're working on making sure like the great language teaching podcasts that we listen to are there. So that was was that from Conversations About Language Teaching? Yeah,
Hi,
with
Diane.
Diane
Hi, Reed.
Neubauer. Hi, Diane. Hi,
Yep.
Reed. And another shout out is the Super Seven. I think that originally came from Terry Waltz.
Yes.
And then that got expanded to the Sweet 16 as well, which has some more specific actions that I think was that Mike Pita that added onto that. I had one thought about the article
Oh.
as well. I mean, I had many thoughts about the article. When I first read this, I think it was released like last December. It got me going. I had a lot of thoughts about it, but looking back over it, the two different groups, the contingent group, the group that got the either or yes, no questions versus the divergent group that got like more of the open-ended questions. So the contingent group did kind of just they started out slightly stronger in their pretest writing. So they did have more verbs, more conjugated verbs, and more accuracy in their pretest.
Yeah.
Both groups did grow in the post-test. However, the contingent group, like if we're looking at skyscrapers, the we've got some apartment buildings and some high rises with the contingent group. So all of them did show growth. And again, like you said, like this was just one class period, and in the further directions, the authors do talk about doing like. That there was a lack of a delayed post-test. So that, I mean, that's something to keep in mind, but at least immediately, pretty good growth.
Yeah, and like if
And
you take a look at the
the
oh sorry.
growth, yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, like, taking a look at the results, like the divergent group actually used more verbs than the contingent group did, but the contingent group had much more accuracy and like actually used the conjugation instead of just using the infinitive or whatever it is, a lot more than the divergent group did. So they both did have growth, but it was like, specifically about accuracy, that seems to have been really effective.
Yeah, and I think you'd be hard pressed to find a language teacher that isn't somewhere in their soul interested in improving student accuracy in their output.
It lurks deep within, no matter how much we learn about proficiency levels and language use, we're like, but you wrote the wrong letter, and I am experiencing emotions and feelings about it.
Right.
That's a good one. So, the moral of the story, use more these what, oh God, now I've confused myself. Contingent
Contingent.
questions, which is either or questions, and that could
Also,
help.
yes or no. It's when you already give the answer or like an option for the answer.
Totally, yeah. So use more of those kinds of questions if and that can help boost accuracy. And maybe, I don't know, try it out. Do some action research in your classroom. Go wild. Try one sort of questioning over another and see what the effects are. But as for, for me, I'm like, if it helps my novices, my ones and my twos and some of my threes as well, build that confidence with new structures in the language in general, then yeah, I want to give them as much confidence early on as possible.
So maybe with that, we can move on to the girl boss section, where we're going to talk about really awesome strategies that have helped us. In the beginning, I had mentioned the idea of kind of trying to use the circling questions to find out more information about your students. That's the idea of like personalizing, using personalized questions and answers, which is PQA. I think that's what it stands for. You want to, instead of just like kind of asking something that seems obvious, it's like you're actually trying to get some information that you don't have, that makes it a little bit more engaging for the listeners. But you're still using the same vocabulary that you want the students to acquire. They're still getting the repetitions. I don't know, like I immediately think of using a strategy like picture talk, where I have like specific verbs in mind or whatever it is that I want the students to acquire. But instead of only asking like either or yes or no questions about what they see, I can also say like, oh, like let's say there's like a fish or whatever. Like, do you have fish? Do you like to eat fish? Do you, I don't know, what other questions can we ask about fish? But it's like I'm like talking to the student, so there's again like the communicative purpose for asking the question, but it is still kind of using it again in a limited way so that they can focus more on the meaning.
Something that I'm working on really, really hard with my upper level students is getting them to ask me for clarification when I use a word that they don't know, and a way that I am when they do tell me like that they need clarification, trying to park on that new word. And one of the ways that I park on a new word is by personalizing. I don't have an example right off the top of my head about like one of the words that I had to park on, but we were talking about something. They said, what's this mean? Let's say that the word was like, I don't know. I'm looking around to see if anything is a good thing to talk about. Super glue. Maybe they didn't know the word for super glue, so I had to stop and park on it. So like, oh, do you use super glue in math class? Probably not. No, you don't use super glue in math class. Do you use super glue in art class? Yeah, you use super glue in art class. Who's ever accidentally glued their fingers together with super glue? Because I just did. I was fixing my water bottle. But so like just parking on it, and then like you can circle that as well, because we've personalized it. Now we can like just park on it with circling. Did I glue my thumb and my pointer finger together, or did I glue my hand to my face?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like another opportunity to introduce like new vocabulary, because even though you're using words that they may not know yet, you're still anchoring it in that word. So like maybe they don't know how to say thumb in the language, but they know that you're talking about super glue, right? And so it's a way to like kind of lessen, I guess, the cognitive load of like introducing multiple different new words in one context versus like only a few at a time, and using the strategy to make sure it's really comprehensible to them.
Totally.
Ben, do you have any
Yeah, I was
thoughts on
going to
this
say too
one?
that like as long as we are circling something, it's kind of the implication is maybe that something in there is new. And so we might make sure that we have written the form up on the board in one color and then its translation to the L1 in another color to show students and then point and pause at that while we're circling to kind of keep that meaning established and keep that in the forefront of students' minds. So they're always connecting the meaning. I've had the experience of hearing a new word in a language like a bunch of times and just knowing that's a new word. And I keep hearing that new word, but if I haven't made the connection, then it might get lost, and that would be a bummer for all the work we did to get that into the input.
And
Yeah,
the putting it on the board also slows you down. You as the teacher, it slows you down. So instead of just knowing, hey, there's a new word, but you're moving too fast, even though you're like, even though you've already said what it is, taking the time to like go over and point to it slows you down enough so that the student can be like, oh, okay, I'm with you, and keep going.
yeah, I think kind of like the view of a certain style, language teachers who advocate for a certain style of teaching where it's basically like illegal to use the L1 at all in the classroom, don't like the idea of writing the definition on the board because it's like, oh, well, no, you should just make them understand what it means by using the circling questions or whatever. But it's like, you save so much time by just simply writing the definition. You don't even say it, just writing it on the board. So then you can then use the circling to actually, ask a new questions. And it's like, okay, we know what that word means, that new word that you keep hearing. So then we can, use it in different contexts. So I think that the idea of using glossing is what it's called, glossing new vocabulary on the word, it can be a really powerful strategy. And well, yeah, just all kinds of teaching, but specifically in this situation.
I agree. I just wrote a blog post for my personal blog that was about target language use. And that was kind of one of the things, or I think I've seen, unless I just made this up willfully because it represents my viewpoint, is that like no matter how hard we try to get the target language to exist in this like abstract concept connected space where it's just like, oh, the word gesso. It exists in my students' head, and when they hear queso, they just see a block of cheese and they don't think the English word at all. And that's just not true. That no matter kind of what we do, students are also going to think it in the L1 anyways, to just be like, oh, he means cheese. So if that's true, then we can just kind of cut to the chase. It's an efficiency thing, but then what you said is totally right, Brian, is that it saves us the time to then get back in and hit them with a bunch of personal questions. And so then you learn more information. They get more input of what the sound of the word is as well compared to how it looks on the board. Yeah, it's just a time saver. So I'm with you on that one. My other consideration that I was thinking about is that I was noticing when I was circling certain things in German, the changes in the word order actually did kind of affect meaning. German is if you invert the subject and the verb, then it becomes a question, a yes or no question. And so when I was trying to be like, did so and so do this or did so and so do this, students were saying back to me what essentially was the question form. And so maybe your language has this too. This was my tip, is that I just switched it around so that if I'm circling and giving an either or with two full sentences in German, I just say them in the correct order instead of how my German brain kind of popped them out. So I would say, he goes to the park or he goes to the store. To the circus, to the circus. So I would say in the correct order because again, I don't want the students saying back to me almost like the question form, right? And so that, you got to make considerations for your language and the responses that you're going to get, and what you think or what you know your students are thinking that means when they're saying that in response.
Yeah, that makes me think about one of the principles of the processing input
Input
processing theory,
processing.
which is that learners will tend to focus on the first word in the sentence for meaning. So if the first word changes the meaning of the sentence, they may just interpret that as being, what. So, like, even if you know that changing the position of the subject and the verb makes it a question or a statement, if you want students to just only focus on the meaning, it's a really good idea to, like you said, just say it, give them the option in the form that you want them to then produce. It's again l l lowering the cognitive load so they don't have to think about it, or they may just not be aware of that concept yet.
Yeah, and I've been thinking
So.
about this too with German, is that like German has flexible word order and you can move things around because so much is inflected. And so if I really want to hit the flexible word order, then I can, make the statements to me gives he the gift or what, whatever it ends up sounding like in English direct translation. But I have to be cognizant of the like, I'm gonna I'm going to lower their cognitive load by lessening the amount of random items in there.
So one more thing that I had that I was thinking about with in relation to circling and my adventures of learning what my level four students need is that these contingent questions can also be used with like complex sentences. So that is also something that we have like a pitfall with is like, oh, I can't circle in or do these questioning strategies in upper levels because they're not just simple sentences. There's not just one thing that I can pull out. So something that I kind of, a light bulb moment for me when I read this article was, oh, well, if I can ask either or questions about a simple sentence, surely I can ask an either or question about a more complex sentence, but just ask it about the complex part. So if, like one day last year, we were talking about things that our parents tell us to do, which in Spanish uses the subjunctive. So like we I was like, oh, do your parents tell you to take out the trash? Do your parents tell you to wash the dishes? Do your parents tell you to walk the dog every night? Class, Ben's parents ask him to walk the dog every night, or do they ask him to walk the dog every morning? So what is it? The independent, no, is it the independent or dependent clause? The main clause, Ben's parents ask him or tell him, is staying the same. I don't need a circle that. We've already used that a bunch. It's not new. But what is new for students probably is the subjunctive form for walk. They've heard camina every single day, maybe every single day since Spanish one, but they might not have heard camine until this point. So I need to circle so that the students are hearing that new form over and over and over. And then I'll just pop it up and say, why camine instead of camina? Oh, because someone else wants them to do it. And then we move on. So that's my like pro tip for upper levels, I guess. And that's something that I would really want to dig into this year with my Spanish four.
And just really quickly, like one thing I was thinking about when I was reading the introductions to the article, when they're talking about like critical thinking and all that, you can, like, the thing about novice learners is that they are not novice thinkers. So even if you're using like a relatively simple linguistic form, you can still ask it about something that seems complex. So like you can be talking about, I don't know, like I had shown a picture of like a street in a city in Senegal that might look a lot different from a street that they might be used to in their home country. And so I could ask them like really simple questions about like, is the street, like your street? Is it clean? Is it dirty? But like, I can use that about something that seems more, and I don't know, something that will get them thinking a lot more about the cultural differences, even though it's, kind of a lower level question.
Totally. Love, 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 love. Do you want me to do the little I just started almost doing it, and then I was like, girl. Okay. Well, then we'll cut whatever this little shedaddle is. And Bill, I have been writing down timestamps religiously, so I will send you a little notes document. Okay. Do you want me to just say,
No
Brian,
worries.
what you said is what Actville said also. yeah, no, Brian, what you said is great. That also aligns with the intercultural reflection tool that ACTFL provides as part of the intercultural can-do statements. That, doing a little bit of internal reflection, they're going to be thinking greater things than they're able to express in their language, maybe. And so having that, opening that door by using simple vocabulary, but having a big thought is awesome. Great. Awesome. Love it. Thank you so much for listening, listeners. We'll see you next time. Go slay your language classes.